You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello, folks, and welcome to PyReps. PyReps is a show dedicated to educating, informing, and piquing the interests of general public, student pilots, and new pilots into the world of commercial and general aviation. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of PyReps. Good evening, folks. Brian and I are here. I'm here with First Officer Brian, and I'm Private Pilot Phil, if you guys remember us from our first podcast. And today we're going to talk about the coming of age in flight training. And we're going to start off with just the first, you know, like my first official flight lesson. That was July the 23rd, 1988, going way back. And I can just remember that I was real nervous on that first flight because I had to figure out how to steer the airplane on the ground with pedals. You don't really steer it with a steering wheel, so it was a little different taxiing and learning how to do that. So I just figured I'd share that experience. I'm sure a lot of young pilots are having the same issue when they first get into an airplane. But First Officer Brian, do you have anything to add to start this program out?
No, just want to say hello to everyone. Hope you had a fantastic Thanksgiving. I know I did for sure. And I look forward to telling you today about my training experiences on my way to my professional career.
Sounds good. And me, I'm Private Pilot Phil, so I merely have a private pilot license.
I wouldn't say merely. having a private pilot certificate is a big accomplishment.
Yeah, it is. And I felt good on that first, when I passed that check ride, it was a great feeling. And we're hoping that we can encourage some students that are just starting out to get to that point. And to be honest, it's not going to be easy. It's not an easy route to get your private pilot's license. There's a lot of ups and downs. I remember a flight instructor telling me one time that it's one step forward and five steps back. And that flight instructor was correct. So, but in the end, it's well worth it.
So basically walk backwards.
Yeah, you're trying to walk forwards, but you're going backwards.
Well, if you take one step forward and five steps backwards, you'll never get there.
Right.
Unless you're walking backwards.
Right.
And then in that case, your forward is your backward. So.
But it's seemingly like that. But
I got you.
Once you reach a point of maturity and know what you're doing, you know you can get there. But, you know, you can, like the first solo. We never think we're going to solo. But when the flight instructor tells us we're ready to solo, we're thinking we're not ready to solo, you know. My first solo was back on May 22nd, 1989. I remember my 21st hour.
Isn't it funny how you always remember as a pilot the first time you soloed?
Yeah.
And you remember the airplane as well?
Yeah.
Yeah. The registration number?
Well, yeah, it's in the logbook too. But he... I remember it was out of 3 Bravo Bravo, and he kept mentioning that he wants, you know, wanted to get me to solo. And at the time, I didn't think I was ready. I'd had about, when I started with this instructor, I had about 13 hours, okay? And so I didn't think I was ready, but he kept mentioning solo, and he kept asking me, did you get your medical? At the time, I didn't know what a medical was, okay? Brand new student pilot, I didn't know what a medical was. Well, it turns out that a medical is when you go get a physical at a designated FAA doctor, known as an AME. So I went, and I got the physical and passed, and I brought this certificate to the flight instructor. He says, okay, now we're going to get you ready to solo. And I'm thinking I'm about, 10 hours away from soloing. You know, every time I would fly the airplane with him, I didn't think I was ready. The landings weren't right, this, that, and other. Then one day we did one takeoff and one landing, and I figure it's just going to be a regular run around in the pattern like usual. So we're taxiing back, and he says, stop the airplane. I said, why do we need to stop the airplane? We're not at the runway yet. He said, was something wrong or anything? He says, no, I'm getting out.
Cool.
I said, what do you mean you're getting out? I'm getting out of here. I want 3 good takeoffs and landings. Okay. Well, I had no idea he was going to get out and let me do them by myself.
Mm-hmm.
So sweating bullets and everything. And then something happened at that moment. What happened was I just started to focus. And I knew I was just going to do these takeoffs and landings as if he were in the airplane, just like I always did with him.
Okay.
I did the three takeoffs and the three landings. And after I taxied back, he congratulated me, and it was just euphoric. It was a euphoric moment. Again, maturity. Mm-hmm. I had matured into solo. And so he gave me a certificate and everything. But I knew I had a long road to go. But it was just an accomplishment along that journey that we call the journey to a private pilot certificate. And it was one of the best days of my life. So do you remember your first solo?
I sure do, yeah. So I started training in June of 2007. That's when I took my first flight lesson. Before that, growing up, I had always known I had wanted to be a pilot. However, in the neighborhood that I grew up in, I didn't know any other pilots or anyone else interested in aviation. I didn't really know how to go about it. I started young. I took my first flight lesson at age 19 in college in my sophomore year. And by that point, I didn't really know, again, really anything about how to get started. So I remember in college talking to my Spanish tutor, telling him that I really wanted to fly, but I didn't really know what I needed to do because the general public may not know, but there actually is no such thing as a pilot degree. You know, you can't get a pilot aviation degree. There are college degrees related to aviation, such as aviation management, so on and so forth, but there is no one specific degree that you need to be a pilot. So I got to college not really knowing anything, talked to my Spanish tutor, and he said, hey, why don't you just go out to a local airport and talk to someone out there? So that's what I did. I went out to my local airport, talked with some of the staff there, and they scheduled a discovery flight for me. A discovery flight is kind of an introductory joyride flight that you can get at most small airports around the countries if they have a flight school. So I did that. And again, I knew I was hooked and I just started training there. This was June of 2007. I was fortunate to be able to progress fairly quickly. So I soloed in July of 2007. So about a month after I started training, I believe I had 11 hours. Just like you, I remember the aircraft, November 89647.
Yep.
Little blue and white Cessna 152, really old school.
Do they have a cruise prop?
No, you're thinking of 364.
Yeah, okay.
24364, yeah. It's an old Cessna 152 that had a cruise prop. So it was a little faster in cruise, but definitely slower and more sluggish in the takeoff. But the one I flew, 647, was an old dog. Got me up in the air, though. I still remember that aircraft. I'm not sure where it's at nowadays, but I believe it might still be flying. I was definitely nervous. My instructor was prompting me and prodding me to solo. I didn't really feel ready. It's kind of one of those things where I don't think you ever really feel ready.
No, you don't. I didn't.
You just kind of do it. But just like you, I do remember once the wheels left the pavement on takeoff, I just went into focus mode because I knew that the only way this airplane's getting back down safely is if I do it, you know. Yeah. So I've got to focus. So I remember, just like you, three takeoffs and landings. I remember feeling really good about myself afterwards. Again, this was July 28th of 2007. And then after solo, I continued to progress fairly quickly and got my license several months later, January 28th of 2008.
Wow, that's fast.
When I became a private pilot.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's extremely fast because it took me forever. It took me 5 years.
Well, I was at the right place and the right time in my life. I was in college, sophomore year, so I was already in a mindset that was conducive to studying because that was pretty much my entire life then, was working and studying. So I more or less felt like just taking an extra college course. I was already taking tons of college courses anyway. It was just one more thing to study. And because I was a college student, I was already accustomed to living cheaply, you know, eating lots of ramen noodles and being a typical college student. So that's what I did. You know, I saved every dime I could get to pay for my training. I took about one lesson every week or every other week usually. And I was fortunate to be able to get done with that fairly quickly.
Yeah, I remember you were always at the airport just studying away. You were always reading a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were actually, you were building your resume to be an airline pilot at that time.
Sure.
You know, especially with a college degree, you just, you can't beat that. I mean, there's a lot of other aviators out there that want to work for the airlines, but you're going to be looked upon quicker with that college degree than yep. the others.
Correct.
Know? So you soloed the first time, and you mentioned the same thing that I did. You don't feel you're ready to solo.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel it. You think that you're still inconsistent, you know, but that's pretty much almost with everything as far as flying. You never think you're ready. You don't think you're ready for the check ride. You don't think you're ready to solo. It's just the way it is. And I guess maybe it's designed that way, mm-hmm. but you kind of, when the moment comes, you just go into, like you say, a focus mode because it's something you have to do. That flight instructor is not going to be on that side all the time. If something happens, it's up to you,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And that's really the goal of training. The term used in the industry is pilot in command. So from your first lesson with your instructor is training you to be a pilot in command. Because once the instructor does get out of the aircraft and you have your certificate, you're flying by yourself or you're flying with friends and family or even professionally, you are going to be the pilot in command. You are the decision maker. The buck stops with you. And so from day one, the goal, in addition to just learning the basic mechanics of how to control the airplane, is mostly developing the mindset of a professional aviator. In all of my experience, I can honestly say it's really probably 10% monkey skills, learning how to do all the basic maneuvers, stay straight and level, climb to higher altitudes, descend, turn, etc. Most of real aviating, that the art of being a pilot is all in your head. It's all the mental stuff that goes along with it.
Very much so. Now, we mentioned soloing. Now, there's something, and I also mentioned an AME, okay? Since you're a flight instructor, you might want to explain to us, before any student can solo, there's something known as, now, things have changed since I was a student, so you might want to correct me on a couple things.
Okay.
Back when I was flying 20-plus years ago as a student pilot, you had to have what was known as a student third-class medical certification before you could solo. You'd have to go to that AME, which was a designated physician.
Aviation medical examiner.
Yes, for mm-hmm. the FAA. And you would have to pass the physical, get that third-class medical before you could solo. Do you want to explain a little bit about that?
Sure. So the basic progression for getting to the point where you're able to solo, there are a couple of things you have to do. Obviously, you have to learn the basic skills for controlling the aircraft. The first phase of flight training in general, and it'll vary slightly based on aircraft and instructor preference and technique, but generally, your first few lessons are geared towards giving you the basic knowledge, skills, and ability to enable you to fly solo, being by yourself. So in your first lessons, you'll be learning things like how to start the aircraft, how to taxi the aircraft, which is just driving it on the ground, how to take off, how to fly straight and level, climb, turn, descend, how to land. That's probably the most challenging part of that phase. You'll be learning the basics of radio communications, pilotage navigation. Pilotage is just a really fancy word for looking out the window and orienting yourself.
Navigation,
so,
yeah.
Exactly. So when I drove to the studio today, I actually used pilotage to get here, just looking out the window and orienting myself based on the landmarks and street signs that I saw. So those are the basic skills you'll be learning initially. Also, basic emergency procedures to get yourself out of, I say common for lack of a better word, but common emergency or abnormal scenarios. The reason why I say, for lack of a better word, is because generally speaking, in an aircraft, no emergency is really common. Aircraft are made to be very safe, as we talked about in the last podcast. So it's highly unlikely that you'd have an emergency event. But again, with you being in the aircraft by yourself, were that to happen, you want to have the basic skills. So that's the flight training portion of getting to the point where you're able to solo. The other portion is the knowledge. So your instructor is required to not only assess your manual flying skills, but your knowledge. So you have to have knowledge of, again, communications, airport operations. There are right of way rules on the airport property, just like on the street, you know, so you have to know the street signs and street etiquette. You also have to know etiquette at the airport. You mentioned the traffic pattern. The traffic pattern is an organized flow around the airport because, again, in the aircraft don't have stop signs and traffic lights. So there's a standardized flow and sequence that aircraft follow at an airport when it comes time to land in the absence of air traffic control. So learning things like that, lots that go into that. And then last but not least, the medical certification. So things have changed a little bit. It's still not uncommon for students to get a third class medical. In fact, if you want to fly professionally like I do, you still need a medical. I need more than a third class, but it's still more or less the same. There's now something called basic med, which...
Yeah, you talked to me about that. Yeah.
Yeah, basic med, that's probably best left for another podcast, but okay. Essentially, in a nutshell, it's an alternative method of gaining your medical clearance without having to jump through all of the hoops of getting a third class medical. It's for people who just want to fly recreationally. It can potentially be a slightly easier method without having to go to an aviation medical examiner, AME, like okay. We talked about.
Yeah.
But in general, you're going to have to do one or the other. You'll have to go through basic med to get your medical clearance or get at least a third class medical through an AME. And they're going to be looking for a general physical condition. So you don't have to be Superman. They're going to check your vision, check your hearing, check your heart, your pulse, things like that. It's more or less your basic physical. If you've ever had a sports physical, something akin to that. There are some disqualifying medical conditions, and I don't have the list in front of me, but if you do a simple Google search, you can easily find out what some of those conditions are. You know, if you've had, for example, diabetes, which requires insulin, or if you've ever had dizziness or fainting spells, loss of consciousness, things like that, heart disease, those can be some conditions that would be disqualifying. But generally speaking, if you're in average health, you'll probably be okay. Once you do that, you demonstrate to your instructor that you have the knowledge and skills necessary to fly the aircraft, and you earn your medical certification. Then your instructor will give you what's called a pre-solo knowledge test. And this test is mandated by the regulations. It's a fairly simple test, can be multiple choice. It's usually designed by your instructor at flight school. And they'll just ask you all the basic questions about the things that you've learned thus far, just to make sure that your knowledge is where it should be.
Okay.
And then once you do that, just like you said, your instructor, depending on their style and personality, they may coordinate with you to let you know ahead of time, because I know for my students, when they soloed, some students liked to have their family and friends there, their parents there to take pictures and cheer them on. So they liked the courtesy of knowing ahead of time. Some instructors, depending on the instructor and or the student, sounds like your instructor did this, will just spring it on the student and say, hey, yeah, I'm hopping out. You know, I've done that on more than one occasion. So
yeah,
usually they'll sign your logbook and send you on your way.
Sounds good. Oh, talking medicals, we're talking about disqualification. In 1998, I disqualified because I had the heart murmur. So that was in, 1998. So every other physical that I had, I had passed up to that point. And it took them a while to discover that murmur. I knew I had had it. I just didn't say anything.
Okay.
They discovered it and disqualified me. So what happened was, and I'm mentioning this just in case there's students out there that come into this issue, they're not going to disqualify you forever. They're just going to want information from your physician, your treating physician, about the condition that they've discovered. And you're going to have to get a report from your doctor, all right? And then you're going to bring it to your AME, and the AME is going to send it down to Oklahoma. And the surgeons, the flight surgeons down there, are going to go over it and look over the information to decide whether or not they're going to issue you your medical. So you would be essentially getting your medical from Oklahoma rather than your AME. That's what happened to me. I don't know. Has anything changed, since then?
That's still more or less the way it is.
Okay.
The basic medical that you can get, there are three classes, first, second, and third. Third being the least stringent, first being the most stringent. Airline pilots need a first-class medical. Other commercial pilots, such as charter pilots, you know, Donald Trump's pilot, for example, they're going to need second-class medicals. And then your basic run-of-the-mill recreational pilot, like yourself, will need at least a third-class medical. Now, if for whatever reason you have a condition that could potentially be disqualifying or that requires further review, the FAA might issue what's called a special issuance medical.
Yeah, that's what they issued me. And what happened was instead of going, now back then we're talking, I'm dating myself. Back then the third class medical was good for 24 calendar months, I believe. But I started to have to go to the AME every year, once a year, with that special issuance.
Yeah, so it depends on your age. If you take the medical exam on or before your 40th birthday, it's good for 60 months or 5 years from the day you take it. If you take it after your 40th birthday, it's good for 2 years or 24 calendar
24
months.
24 calendar, yeah.
So for you, it would have actually been good for 5 years for third class privileges, which is your typical recreational type flying. If you get a special issuance, there may be alternative timelines. So like you said, for example, you had to go back every year. And that, depending on your situation and the restrictions contained within your special issuance, could be the case.
Right.
So for special issuance medicals, again, if you have a medical condition that will require one, when your medical is issued, it'll be issued with something that says something like, you know, you have this medical, and I'm obviously paraphrasing. I'm not an AME, but we'll give you this medical subject to these conditions. You have to abide by these limitations while you're flying, and you have to visit a doctor, an AME, every year instead of every 2 years or every 5 years or whatever the case may be. So that's usually how they get around it, just to keep a closer eye on whatever the condition might be. Now, my recommendation, and this comes from having experience as a flight instructor, and thankfully, although I didn't go through this special issuance process myself, I did train several students who did require special issuance medicals. My advice is, if you think you have, if you're interested in flying and you think you have a medical condition that would require a special issuance or that might require one or you're not sure, I recommend calling or setting up an appointment to speak with an AME ahead of time. Most AMEs are pretty good about that. They, depending on the AME themselves, they may or may not want to charge you for their time. But even if they do, I think it's still worth it to sit down with them before and discuss it. Because again, neither you or I are medical professionals. They can give you all the details about what's disqualifying and what's not disqualifying, what the rules are for exceptions, what you have to do as far as the hoops that you have to jump through. It'll be very worthwhile, because once you go in for that medical exam, if they discover something at that time, just like what happened to you, then your file is already in the system and it's going to start the entire process of, okay, well, now we have to send it off to the FAA headquarters in Oklahoma City. And it's going to take months or years for us to make this review and determine whether or not we're going to issue it. It just becomes a really big hassle. So
it did, really.
I recommend going in beforehand off the record with your AME and saying, hey, this is, you know, this is my medical history. I think this may or may not be disqualifying. What do you think? And then they can guide you from there.
Yeah. I had quite a few. I had the migraine headaches and everything. They were concerned about that. But that's just something to keep in mind if you're a student pilot, because the FAA is kind of critical on certain things. They've kind of gotten relaxed on some other things that they might have been tight on once before. Mm-hmm. But I've been kind of out of the game for a little while here, so I don't really know the new regs that have popped up with medicals and whatnot, but you kind of keep me abreast of all that.
Yeah. So. Well, I'd say some great resources. If you have an instructor, if you're a student, talk to your instructor. Your instructor will know. If not, ecfr.gov is the government's website where they keep all of their current regulations. So if you go to ecfr.gov, Title 14, which is Aeronautics and Space, and then Part 61, and I know that's a lot to remember, so you might have to play it back later, but If you look for that website and those links, it'll take you to all the most current regulations so you can see exactly in the FAA's wording what the requirements are and what they're looking for.
That is great information, and we appreciate that information put out there for these young students out there, even new pilots. If you're a new pilot, you're still not going to know everything. Mm-hmm. If you just get that private license, private pilot certificate, you're not going to know everything. Because everything is, sometimes it just comes in so fast,
mm-hmm.
All the regs and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, I always told my students, and I'm sure you've probably heard this yourself, a private pilot certificate is a license to learn. So when you get it, you've demonstrated to your instructor, to your examiner, to the FAA that you meet the minimum level of proficiency to operate safely in the airspace. But that's a minimum. I kind of liken it to being a doctor, so the medical profession has changed over the past 20 or 30 years. Medicines that are on the market today are not necessarily the same as medicines that were on the market when I was a kid. Medical procedures and techniques have evolved. Technology in the medical field has evolved. You wouldn't want to go to a doctor who's still using medical methods from 30 years ago,
They're not
reading the latest medical journals. They're not practicing medicine according to the latest technological advances and standards. And it's the same as a pilot, or it's the same for pilots, rather. Technology in aviation has advanced. Aircraft systems has advanced. Airspace and regulations have advanced and changed. So just because you get your private pilot certificate, it doesn't stop there. You should always be learning and growing and staying current and up to date with the most recent information in order to stay safe.
Which brings me to this is the, I don't know if you can let me know if they still have this. When I became a private pilot, I wanted to stay safe. Okay. So I joined what was known back then as the WINGS program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a pilot proficiency program. You basically go up with a flight instructor. I forget. I think it's once a year or something like that to do some maneuvers and to keep your proficiency up, and then they send you a certificate, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't remember if it was once a year or whenever it was, but I still had those certificates, but that's something that I pursued once I had my private. Do they still have the WINGS program?
Yeah, it's actually funny you mentioned that. The WINGS program is a program created by the FAA for the goal of keeping pilots proficient. So without getting too far into the weeds, once you, again, get your private pilot certificate, the training and the learning doesn't stop there. At a bare minimum, the FAA requires you to pass what's called a flight review. So every 2 years, every 24 calendar months, you have to go up again with a flight instructor, demonstrate that you still meet the proficiency requirements for the license, do at least an hour of flight training and an hour of ground instruction satisfactorily in order to keep your privileges. So it's not like your driver's license where you pass one road test and you can drive for 50 years. You have to continue to demonstrate proficiency at least every 2 years.
So I remember now you sparked a memory. It was, it counted as a flight review.
Correct.
I remember now.
Yeah.
And it was every 2 years?
Well, it depends. So the WINGS program, what the FAA found is that the 2 year minimum, although it could potentially be adequate, is not necessarily adequate for everyone.
Right.
It's a minimum of 2 years. So what the FAA did was they said, okay, well, let's promote a culture of proficiency to encourage pilots to not just when the end of that second year is coming up, say, oh man, I got to go grab an instructor and I'll go do a lap around the traffic pattern, go do my minimum 1 hour of flight training, 1 hour of ground training just to stay current, because there's a difference between currency and proficiency. How can we encourage pilots to continue their aviation education? So what they did was create the WINGS program, and the WINGS program has different phases, and it encompasses certain ground elements and certain flight elements.
Right.
So typically the WINGS program will sponsor certain aviation seminars, usually around this time of year in the fall and winter when people aren't out flying as much. And if you come to a seminar, you can listen, you can participate, you can discuss different aviation topics, and your attendance at that seminar qualifies as ground instruction, more or less. So if you do a certain number of seminars on the ground and you do a certain number of flight lessons in the air, so for example, you go to the Wings website, you're working towards one of your Wings proficiency levels, and that particular level requires you to demonstrate certain flight maneuvers in the air with your flight instructor. Well, once you go up on your next lesson and you demonstrate those maneuvers, now you get flight training credit for Wings. So once you complete a phase of ground training and flight training under the Wings program, it satisfies part of your flight review requirements.
That's great. That's awesome. And it's a little more of a relaxed way to do it, too, if I remember it correctly. It's kind of just like going up with a flight instructor and doing maneuvers, and then they sign you off pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just making sure you're safe.
Yeah. My explanation was kind of a long and drawn out and roundabout
right.
way of saying that. Basically, it's very similar to private pilot training. You know, when you go up for a lesson, you do a little bit of ground instruction, you go up and you do some maneuvers or procedures in the air, and you land and debrief, and that's it. That was your typical lesson as a student pilot. Well, that's what the Wings program is geared towards. And the flight review is also pretty similar, but the flight review, again, the FAA is trying to get away from the mindset of just, I only have to think about safety and training once every 2 years. They want us to constantly be thinking about safety and training. So by incorporating the Wings program, these different phases more frequently and regularly, it fosters more of a culture of safety.
That's fascinating. And as far as training goes, you know, when I was a student, I wanted to get my experience with both non-controlled and controlled airports. Mm-hmm. So I started off at Pontiac, and then I went to Big Beaver and trained for a while, and ultimately ended up at Willow Run because I wanted to train not only with control tower and talking to ATC experience, mm-hmm. but I also wanted to experience what it's like to fly into uncontrolled fields. So by the time I got to my private, I was trained on both sides of the fence.
So for listeners who might not know, can you explain the difference between controlled and uncontrolled?
Controlled field means you have an airspace, usually a Class Delta. Okay. It has a, like Willow Run, for example, is Class Delta. Mm-hmm. And it's a control tower. So you're going to get instructions from the time you talk to ground control. They're going to instruct you how to taxi to the runway. Mm-hmm. They're going to give you clearance for takeoff. They're going to give you clearance for the option if you're in the pattern.
Okay.
They're going to give you clearance to land. And they're also going to, once you're clear of the airspace, they'll let you go, but they're going to stay in control of you as long as you're in that airspace. They're also going to clear you into an airspace whenever you call in, that kind of thing. Uncontrolled field, you're talking on the radio and you're announcing your intentions. Okay. Big Beaver traffic, Cessna 69120 is about 10 miles to the north. We'll be inbound, entering a left downwind for runway 27, Oakland Troy, that kind of thing. So you are announcing to the other aircraft in that pattern where you're at and when you're going to be coming into that traffic pattern. Whereas the tower on a controlled field, they have everybody on the radar and they're giving instructions as to how you set up for the pattern.
So I guess in a nutshell, a controlled airport is more like coming to an intersection where you have a crossing guard or a police officer waving certain traffic through and stopping other traffic and basically directing the traffic, whereas a pilot-controlled airport, or what used to be called a non-controlled airport, is like coming to a roundabout.
Yes.
Where there are certain rules and
regulations,
and there's a certain right-of-way and a flow to the traffic, but there is no central agency or person directing the traffic.
Right.
Everybody just kind of follows the rules and everyone knows the order and the flow, and that's what allows the system to work.
Yeah. I mean, you're in an uncontrolled field, you are responsible for separating yourself from other traffic mm-hmm. and letting the other traffic in the traffic pattern know where you're at so that there isn't any mishaps or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, I think of a student flies trains from both types of airports, that's very beneficial.
Okay. In what ways?
Well, let's say a student only... Now, I've known a few pilots who only trained in uncontrolled airports.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They start from the time they start to the time they almost end their training. They're in an uncontrolled field. Now, sure, the flight instructor is going to take you to some controlled fields just to get you used to it or get you trained. But when there comes a point, if you're flying into a controlled field and you're not used to talking to ATC, you may get intimidated. So it's good to have, during your training, a lot of training in controlled airspace. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think I agree that there's definitely benefit to both. I've been fortunate to train students at both types of airports. So I've had students who've done all of their primary training at pilot-controlled airports and other students who've done all their primary training at tower-controlled airports. And what I've found is that, generally speaking, the pilots who train at tower-controlled airports become very comfortable talking to air traffic control because they start doing it from day one. They actually feel uncomfortable going to a pilot controlled airport because they feel like, hey, this is like the wild, wild west. Like, I don't have anybody telling me what to do or where to go. And someone on the ground looking out for me, you know, another set of eyes, making sure that I don't get too close to other aircraft. They're uncomfortable with the lack of order. I shouldn't say lack of order because there is still order at a pilot controlled field, but
they're mistrusting what the other pilot's intentions are.
Yeah. There's no one directing traffic. So that gives them a feeling of unease.
They need the hand to be held.
Exactly. So, exactly. Whereas pilots who train at pilot controlled airports in their initial training get used to that. They learn the radio calls. They learn the right of way rules, the protocol for flying at a pilot controlled airport. They don't have to, they broadcast their intentions over the radio to other pilots who may be in the vicinity at the airport, but they don't have to communicate back and forth with any air traffic control. And so, and they get comfortable with that. And then they go to a airport with a control tower and then they get mic fright when they have to actually communicate with another human being one-on-one over the radio.
I mean, it's happened to all of us. I've gotten mic fright on the radio, believe it or not, because it's just, sometimes I would, did I get the ATIS right? That kind of thing. So you're kind of like frozen for a second.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I've noticed, like, for instance, you know, I was flying with a pilot one time. It was me and another pilot, two other pilots, and the pilot in command. He had not had much experience flying into a controlled field. So I was in the back seat. We're flying into PTK, and you know how you set up, you're coming off of, say, 1 Delta 2, and you're setting up 11 miles south, and they're going to ask you to make that left downwind and report a mile south.
Sure. So for people listening, PTK and 1 Delta 2 are different airport codes for local airports here in Southeast Michigan.
So the tower comes back, you know, we called in the tower, told me I have information, and the tower says make left downwind. For 27 left. So I noticed that the pilot in command started making a left turn. Because when the controller told him to make left downwind, he made the mistake of thinking that he had to make a left turn. So what he was going to do was set up on a right downwind for niner right. So I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, nope, make that left turn, left, you know, obstruction, right turn to downwind. So all that was is he was a little intimidated by going into the controlled field. When the air traffic controller told him to make that left downwind, he got a little bit panicked and started to make a left turn instead of the right turn onto the left downwind. That's all that was, because he was more used to flying into uncontrolled fields. So that's our example.
Great. And that illustrates a good point. Like we said back in the beginning of the podcast, flying is probably 10% physical skill. It's 90% mental.
Yeah.
So by this point, I'm sure the pilot you were flying with was rated in the aircraft. He had demonstrated proficiency in being able to fly it before. You know, he can get the airplane up and down in the air and from point A to point B, but it's all the mental work that goes on behind the scenes of, like you said, if air traffic control assigns you a certain entry method into the airport environment, and you're flying in three-dimensional airspace where there are no lanes, there is no stop signs, there is no turn here.
Right.
You have to be able to visualize exactly what they're asking you to do and do it correctly.
Yeah. He just panicked. The two of us, he had me and the other pilot with him, so we told him to just make the right turn. We're making a left downwind for 2-7 left. It calmed him down. We were able to make the turn and set up for the pattern. Mm-hmm. Had we not been there, I don't know. But all it was just a panic mechanism for him because he wasn't used to controlled fields. The other thing is, with uncontrolled fields, if you're a student and you're training at a specific field, it's good to learn. Like, for instance, Victor Lima-Lima. Mm-hmm. It has a specific entry that you have to go in for runway 27.
Okay.
Whereas you come in, you want to go up over Beaumont Hospital, circle around it, and enter a 45-degree left downwind for 27. Okay. A lot of pilots don't know that if they're not familiar with flying into that airfield, that kind of thing. So I think what I rented from there, it benefited me to learn that. But again, it goes back to training at uncontrolled fields. If you do it more often, you're going to learn the traffic pattern set up for that specific airport, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, it's good to have both, you know, the controlled and uncontrolled training.
I agree.
Absolutely. So I wanted to talk a little bit about a really, you know, because we're going to get into this. Once you solo, your flight instructor is going to want you to do the real scary maneuver of stalls. Mm-hmm. Okay. Stalls affect students in different ways. Some panic over stalls because they can be scary at first. And if you're not doing them the right way as a young student pilot, you can get scary situations happen. And I had that happen to me in 1989 after I did my first solo. My instructor wanted me to go out to the practice area and practice departure stalls and approach and landing stalls.
Okay.
I wasn't really experienced in them as far as what I needed to be at that time. I had had maybe 22, 23 hours. Okay. So what happened is I was nervous about it, and I went out to the practice area. We used to have from Big Beaver, we used to have a practice area out over Stony Creek, okay, 10 miles north. So anyway, I set up for this departure stall. Completely did it wrong. Pulled power back 60 knots. I went full power and pulled that nose up, I'd say maybe 20, 30 degrees. If I looked over my shoulder, I could see the ground. That's how steep the pitch was.
Okay.
Okay.
So you went from flying straight and level and steady to pointing the aircraft.
I set up for the stall, pulled it back to 60 knots as if we were going to be rotating off the runway.
Okay.
3,000 feet MSL, full power and pulled the
So you basically pointed the aircraft straight up in the air.
Pretty much straight
until
up.
Until it stalled. And I can imagine that probably wasn't it's a happy ending, but probably it wasn't the ending you anticipated.
It didn't really pitch down. It stayed nose up, but we started to roll over on its back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, luckily, I can tell you, since it was a Cessna 152, that airplane pretty much takes a student's hand, okay? That's how forgiving it is. Mm-hmm. But it rolled over on its back, and what I was not doing is I was not releasing the control wheel pressure to break the stall.
Okay.
Because I was in a panic. Okay, so I did about three times, same thing. And I went back to my flight instructor. I said, I think I'm doing something wrong here. He went up with me and I demonstrated, and he started kind of laughing at me. He says, you know, you realize these are aerobatics, not stalls. So what happened was I had a high anxiety because I didn't know how to do stalls correctly. So if you could just take us into that, because students are going to have to face this eventually, and stalls are scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Now, I want to give a disclaimer. I am an instructor, but I'm probably not your instructor. And even if I am your instructor, if you're listening, still talk to me before you just take my advice here on the podcast. So please keep that in mind. Of course, go do your own study, talk to your own instructor, follow his or her advice. But generally speaking, as an instructor, stalls always have one cause, which is exceeding the critical angle of attack. Now, that's a little bit of a technical term, but what it basically means is that you fly the aircraft at an angle where the wings cannot develop enough lift to sustain the aircraft.
Don't mean to interrupt, but the folks that are like general public listening, mm-hmm. stalls have nothing to do with the engine. It's not an engine failure.
True.
It's an aerodynamic loss of lift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the wings always need a certain amount of air flowing over them in order to be able to sustain the aircraft in flight. And when that angle or when that amount of air is not enough, generally due to the angle with which the wing cuts through the air being too great, you stall. Now, the good thing about almost all training aircraft, at least all the ones that I can think of and all the ones that I've trained students in, is that, like you said, Bill, they're all very forgiving. They're designed to be more or less recoverable on their own. If you're a student pilot, once you get into weight and balance with your instructor, you'll find out that general aviation airplanes, almost all of them, with the exception of if you're flying like a Canard, for example, but your typical conventional general aviation small airplane is made to be nose heavy, meaning that it bounces on what's called the center of gravity. The tail or the back end of the airplane has what's called a tail down force. And usually the heaviest part of the airplane is the front where you've got the engine. And it's made to always want to tip over on the front. If you can imagine balancing the aircraft on your finger, the airplane's always going to want to go nose down towards the ground. Now, that's balanced by the tail down force. So if you can picture it like the airplane being on a teeter-totter, well, if you increase that angle of attack that I mentioned too high, and as long as you don't try to fight the airplane, it'll typically want to recover on its own. Now, there is a recovery sequence, and again, I'm not your instructor, so I won't go into it here. You can talk to your instructor about it. But I say all that to say stalls really are not, they don't have to be as scary as people make them out to be. An airplane still has wings. Your typical training aircraft is only different from a glider in that it has an engine and a glider doesn't. So even if the engine stops for whatever reason, which is unlikely, but it could happen, or if you stall, your plane turns into a glider, not a rock. It'll want to go nose down. So basically, if the angle of attack gets too high, the airplane will want to nose over, point down toward the ground, recover that airflow over the wing on its own, reducing the angle of attack, and it'll want to keep flying if you let it. Now, if you fight it as a pilot, because it's counterintuitive, if the airplane starts to point down on its own toward the ground, most pilots' initial reaction is, oh boy, something's going to happen, so I've got to point the nose of the aircraft back up. What that's actually going to do is increase angle of attack.
Yeah, it's going to potentially put it into aggravated stall condition.
Or spin, if you're not careful.
We were going to get to the spin thing next, which is, you want to call it one-wing stalls before the other, and you have results in auto-rotation. Mm-hmm. That's just the simple term.
Yeah, it's where one wing is stalled more than another to a higher degree. So essentially, if you stall in perfectly coordinated flight, meaning that the aircraft is flying perfectly straight ahead, it's not pointed sideways in the air, then depending on the design of the aircraft, most trainers will stall straight ahead. So the front of the aircraft will just fall over straight ahead towards the ground until you recover. If you are uncoordinated, if the aircraft is flying kind of sideways or in an uncoordinated manner and you stall, then you're more likely, depending on the design of the aircraft and the flight condition you were in previously, to enter a spin. And that's like in the old movies, if you see, you know, in a war movie, an aircraft being shot down and you see smoke trailing in the aircraft, it's kind of spiraling down in a corkscrew pattern. That's what a spin looks like.
Yeah, uncoordinated ball, not centered. Mm-hmm. I had a flight instructor. Every flight instructor I've flown with, I wanted to learn something from them, something special, you know. And I remember one taught me that you could actually fly minimum controllable airspeed without using aileron, just the rudder. And once he taught me how to do that, I started going out in the practice area on my own, even as a private pilot, and doing minimum controllable, okay, just with rudder, to keep it rolling, keep it from rolling, just with rudder, keeping the power in there, keeping the speed, not using aileron at all, just keeping the power, you know, back pressure on the elevator, on the control wheel, just to maintain pitch, but not using any aileron. So I don't know. I guess that goes hand in hand with potential spins when you're using that rudder to get you out of that situation.
Sure, definitely.
So, but minimum, well, that's completely, you know, we can talk about minimum controllable probably on the next podcast.
Yeah, we're definitely
getting a lot of maneuvers we need to.
Yeah, we're definitely getting a little, hopefully not too technical with the terms pitch and minimum controllable airspeed and ailerons, elevators, all those things. But there's definitely a lot to learn, as you can see.
So we got about 10 minutes left in the show.
Okay.
But I do, what I'd like to do even on the next podcast is continue with those maneuvers. So maybe in the next podcast we'll have, we'll talk about maneuvers specifically.
Okay.
Because it's something that students need to know. Mm-hmm. But we can go on with check rides right now.
Okay.
That check ride is, you know, some students might not get nervous about it, but I know I was on my first one.
Mm-hmm.
I remember they set me up with an examiner. He was an old World War II pilot, I believe. Okay. And I just remember he wanted carb heat every 3 minutes. Okay. And I wasn't adjusted to that with any instructors I'd flown with. This was back in 92. So I went to Willow Run. Now, the thing is, we scheduled this thing late, and I didn't have much night, you know, night flying in.
Mm-hmm.
And he had he was notorious for running late. So I get to the airport around 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And I just remember bouncing this ball against the wall because I was so nervous. Mm-hmm. You know, again, maturity. I didn't have the maturity. I was, instead of sitting there studying and getting ready for the check ride, I was bouncing a ball against the hangar wall,
mm-hmm.
waiting for him to get there. Anyway, it was a real rough check ride. He was like a drill sergeant. He had me intimidated. And on the way back to the airport, he asked me, he says, you know what airport you're headed towards? I said, yeah, I'm headed towards Willow Run. We're going back, right? This was after I'd been all shook up. And after he had taken the controls a couple of times. But actually, I found that he was trying to help me out rather than fail me. But I thought that since he took the controls that I'd automatically failed and everything went downhill.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he told me I was heading towards Metro instead of Willow.
Wow.
That sealed my fate right there. But the next year, when we talk about maturity growing, you know, growing, that very next year, the whole summer, I was ready. I knew I was ready. In fact, I called him and asked him to come with me as a flight instructor that October of 93 to see, you know, what kind of, if I've improved at all.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went up with me as a flight instructor, he had his clipboard and everything, just like he did with the exam. But he knew that I could fly the airplane. We did every maneuver, everything, navigation. And when we got on the ground, he said, you know, had this been the check ride, you'd have passed. I said, I know that. Now let's do the real thing. So we fast forward to November 12th, 1993. He shows up at the airport. You know, we schedule the check ride with him. This mm-hmm. is my second time with him. And I kind of noticed when he got in the airplane, he didn't have his checkboard. He did not have his clipboard with him.
Hmm.
So I knew immediately that he had already in his mind passed me because he knew that I could fly. We mm-hmm. did the check ride. Everything was pretty flawless. And I passed.
Good for you.
So, but we want to emphasize not to get too excited and anxious about a check ride.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because now I look at check rides a little bit differently than I did when I first started. In my opinion, the first check ride is probably always the hardest because it's your first. You don't really know what to expect. You don't have the experience of having dealt with check rides before. Now, as a professional pilot flying for the airlines, I take check rides at least once a year. So I've taken so many check rides now that I won't say you get comfortable with it. I kind of look at it like going to the dentist. You know, it's like one of those things that you're not really looking forward to, but you know you're going to have to do on a regular basis, so you just kind of deal with it.
Right.
And mentally prepare yourself for it. But as long as you're competent, usually you'll do okay. The good thing is, again, you have a flight instructor as a student pilot, And your flight instructor will hopefully know when you're ready, just like they knew when you're ready to solo. They'll know when you're ready for your check ride. So you may not feel ready, but your typical flight instructor who has any amount of experience will know when you're ready to go. And so all you have to do is just try not to psych yourself out at that point.
That's hard not to do.
Oh, it's definitely hard not to do, again, especially the first one, because you go in not knowing what you don't know.
Right.
But after you take the first one and just get that out of the way, I won't say it ever gets really easy, but I think, at least in my experience, it got a little easier because you can draw on your previous experience of knowing, like, okay, well, I remember my last check ride. Was it scary? Sure, but I survived it. I got through it, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, like I said, I failed the first one in 92. And then something inside of me said, okay, well, you know, you go through that little period, well, I'm a failure, this and that, I'll never get to be a pilot, whatever. But then you realize that you've been as far as you can go. You know everything you need to know. It's just a matter of brushing up on the things that you made a mistake on that check ride. That's sure. All it was. That's all it was for me.
Yeah.
And I went the extra mile of getting to know that examiner. Because he was kind of a drill sergeant that first time. But I wanted to get to know him so that I would be comfortable again on that second check ride. And it all worked out for me.
That makes sense. And that actually illustrates a very important point, because I think part of the anxiety for most people comes from the fear of failure. And it's important to emphasize that worst case scenario, even if you do fail the initial check ride, it's not the end of the world.
It's a learning experience.
It's a learning experience. So your career is not over. Your chance of being a pilot is not shot. Thankfully, I've been fortunate enough to never fail a check ride, but there are many pilots who have failed a check ride, sometimes for reasons of their own. Maybe they just didn't study hard enough or whatever the case might be. Sometimes just due to, you know, those unfortunate times where something unexpected happens that you didn't anticipate and it just catches you off guard. The one student I've had that failed their check ride, similar situation, he just psyched himself out. It was on, without giving his name or any specific information, VOR navigation, which is a form of ground-based navigation.
I had a heck of a lot of trouble with that in my time.
fairly old school by today's GPS methods, but it was commonplace when I taught this student. I knew he knew how to use VORs for navigation, but same thing. He got in the cockpit, got airborne, got intimidated when the examiner started asking him a few questions, and just kind of psyched himself out. Made a mistake that probably wouldn't have cost him the check ride, but because it got inside of his head, his performance went downhill. And
that's what happened to me. Same thing.
So try not to psych yourself out if you're a student pilot preparing for your check ride. Know that even though you don't feel like you're ready, your instructor will know when you're ready. Not only is your reputation, but their reputation as an instructor is on the line, because they're writing their name in your logbook as well.
Absolutely.
Just something to think about.
And plus, you know, you got to know that you're going up, when you're going up with that examiner, you're going up with a stranger. You're not going up with your instructor.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know the characteristics of that examiner.
Sure.
You don't know what they're going to want. You don't know if they're going to throw a surprise at you. Like with the one I was up with, he wanted card peed every 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't every 3 minutes, he would yell at me. So that was on the first check ride.
Okay.
So I was intimidated and got myself psyched out and figured I had failed already. And when he really didn't fail me, but I thought I had already failed. So everything went downhill from that point on, even to the navigation where I was flying towards Metro instead of Willow Run because of the night experience I didn't have, and it was getting dusk. So there you go. You know?
Yeah. I'll tell you a quick story about the closest I've ever come to failing a check ride. It was my multi-engine commercial check ride. So I had already passed my private pilot check ride, my instrument rating check ride, and my commercial single engine check ride. Commercial single engine allowing me to basically get paid to fly single engine aircraft. But in order to fly anything with more than one engine, you need a multi-engine rating.
Right.
So I went to get that. I actually did accelerated training. So I went for a weekend to this flight school, studied beforehand. So I knew the systems, the procedures, the limitations of the specific aircraft I would be flying. But it was my first time in that aircraft. And for the type of rating that I was getting, it's called an add-on rating. So the requirements are not as tedious as getting an initial rating. So long story short, I went in, flew this airplane for a weekend, and after on my third day of flying the aircraft, I was taking my check ride with a stranger. And so I knew the aircraft, sure, but I was not as comfortable in the aircraft as I had been in the previous aircraft that I'd been flying at that point for several years. And this aircraft was a little more complex. It had retractable gear, you know, the wheels that fold up and down. And on one of the approaches, really the multi-engine check ride is all about, and training in general is all about not what to do when both engines are working, but what to do if one of the engines stops working. Because that's when flying a multi-engine
asymmetrical
aircraft,
stuff and
asymmetric thrust, yeah, and lots of other, it can get very complicated. So that's really what the training's about. So I was doing a single engine ILS approach. The examiner, he simulated an engine failure. So I was flying this airplane with one of the two engines. I was already busy. It was a busy approach. I had a lot going on. And because I was still relatively new to the airplane and my brain was already on overload and I was nervous because it was my check ride, I forgot to lower the landing gear. So normally in this aircraft, when you're flying that traffic pattern that we talked about, and you get to a certain point where you're beamed the end of the runway, you want to have the landing gear down before you start your final descent for landing.
As you're going to start slowing it up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because he had thrown so many curveballs at me with simulated failures and things that I wasn't expecting, my brain got so saturated that I forgot to do my before landing checklist, and I almost forgot to put the landing gear down.
Holy cow.
And he obviously wouldn't have let me land with no landing gear, but at some point he would have said, okay, all right, my aircraft, I'm going to have to, you know, to fail you at this point. But long story short, I got down to about, I think it was maybe 400 or 500 feet. And hearkening back to my previous training, I just tried to clear my mind and think, okay, all right, what do I need to be doing? What's coming next? And it dawned on me, the landing gear wasn't down. So I said, oh, shoot, lower the landing gear, landed safely and uneventfully, ended the check ride. And so we pull off the runway and stop the aircraft. And he said, you know, about another 10 seconds and I would have to fail you. You know, he was just
really
waiting to see if I was going to forget or not. And thankfully I remembered, but it's one of those things where
he does that. He did some of that on purpose.
Probably more than
stretch you out,
yeah,
to see how you react.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's one of those things where I had to consciously clear my mind because here I am flying this aircraft in a non-normal situation with simulated failures. And had I allowed myself to get psyched out and miss something, then I would have failed the check ride. But I was able to get my mind and my thinking under control and was able to still pass.
Good for you.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
Probably a little bit of luck and a little bit of skill.
Yeah, that's the way of flying is. That's the way flight training is. You got to have a little luck thrown in there.
Yep.
You know. So, well, we're going to wrap this up for this episode of Pi Reps. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we've got a few more good things to come up and topics to talk about in our future shows. And for Pi Reps, for First Officer Brian Johnson and Private Pilot Phil, have a good night and have a great week.
We'll talk to you soon, folks. Take care.